Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, The Perfect Moment, a new book all about the culture wars in America and how things like The Simpsons and Murphy Brown were at the heart of it. Fleabag turns 10 and we ask, did it change TV forever? And of course, all the week's TV you'll want to stream or skip, you can email us screentime@newstalk.com. Good weekend to you all, and I do hope you're doing well. A lot of correspondence about The Odyssey, and a lot of people gone to see it or planning to go and see it, and even people stopping me when I do my rounds saying they were really looking forward to seeing it. And most people who've seen it seem to have really enjoyed it. Now, this is just based on the people who got in touch with me through this show and people I met. And it's a big event and it's great. It makes me happy that so many people are going to the cinema. Now, even if you think The Odyssey isn't as good as people are making it out to be, and one or two people said that to me, at least people are going to see a movie that a lot of people like. I don't really think there's much emperor's clothes about this. So cinemas are packed, and they're packed with people watching a really good movie that's nearly 3 hours long, that is supremely shot, and I for one couldn't be happier about that. So cinema, it appears to be alive and well, even though the sun's breaking the stones a lot of the time lately. People are going in their droves to see The Odyssey, and hallelujah, brothers and sisters. A lot of people also in touch about the Will Ferrell interview last week, which they enjoyed. They're not enjoying The Hawk as much on Netflix, one or two people suggested to me, but they're enjoying Will Ferrell in it. Also, plenty of people on social media complaining that I described soccer as football when I was talking to Will Ferrell. Look, I know that GAA, that's football. But as long as I've known soccer, I've always called it football. And I always will. And if you don't like it, turn over. Tune out. Please don't. I need all the listeners I can get. Anyway, we're all in it together. Now, this week in TV, I was watching this.
Who were those people? Why are they shooting at
us? I can't tell you. I don't know.
DCXX? What is this?
I don't know. I think somebody wanted me to find it.
DC. Debbie Claiborne. Those are my initials.
It's me. No. What are my initials doing?
Debbie, will you wait? Will you just calm down?
Calm down? Calm down! You've got a gun. The wing mirror has been shot off. And I don't even know how we got to this van.
Oh, we stole it.
We stole it.
Yes, Hannah Waddington, the great Hannah Waddington, most people know from Ted Lasso, and also Octavia Spencer, the brilliant American actress. And this is a new Amazon Prime show that came out last week. Prime Video is how it's meant to be addressed. And it is 8 parts, and it landed last week, I believe it is. And the two of them are best pals. Octavia Spencer plays Debbie Claiborne, who's married to a very prominent politician, and she's friends with Hannah Waddington's character, Judith. She's also called Whiptail, because it turns out Whiptail, Hannah Waddington's character, is a trained assassin and has been for 25 years and has been lying to her about who she is, even though they're best friends. She's a trained assassin. She's not getting on well as an assassin. And basically, through a kind of ludicrous plot, which is fine, they go on a road movie of sorts, trying to escape, trying to figure out who killed Debbie's husband, the possible future prime minister, and also possibly trying to carry out Whiptail's last kill. So it's a buddy comedy thriller. And you know what? It's very entertaining. The plot's a bit daft, but there is terrific chemistry. Absolutely terrific chemistry between Hannah Waddington and Octavia Spencer. And I smiled a lot through this. I also found it got better as it went on. The first episode, I was thinking, this is tame enough, but it drew me in. So that is Ride or Die on Prime Video for your streaming pleasure. 4 stars, or just about 4 stars, I'd give it on Prime Video. So do check it out. I was also watching Lucky this week on Apple TV, where Anna Taylor-Joy plays pretty badass on the run from some very bad people. It's not a comedy. it's also very good and good summer entertainment. So that's something else to check out. That's on Apple TV. It's called Lucky. I only watched 3 episodes of that, but I did enjoy it very much. Kind of Tarantino-esque. Anya Taylor-Joy is really tough and very fast and very good at escaping very bad people after she disappears with a load of money or something like that. Lucky on Apple TV, also worth your streaming hours this week. Something else that is worth your time this week coming is, in the opinion of the censor, John Kelleher, the former film censor's feature documentary about 100 years of Irish movie censorship. It goes out on RT1 television Monday, the 27th of July at 9:35. Do check it out. John Kelleher knows his stuff. And it's something somewhat related on a wider scale that we turn to now. 4 years ago, we spoke to Isaac Butler about his brilliant book, The Method, How the 20th Century Learned to Act, which was obviously all about method acting. For his latest book, Isaac is writing about something rather different, and that's the culture wars in America. The perfect moment, God, sex, art, and the birth of American culture wars charts how a group of very committed and often strange people banded together to take aim at what they saw as attacks on good taste and indeed Christian value in the arts. And of course, these often focused on movies and TV shows, as well as photography, painting and theatre. Oh, and rap music. We will get into that. I'm delighted to say that Isaac Butler joins me now from the East Coast of America. Isaac, how are you?
Doing great, John. It's wonderful to be back.
Listen, the most facile question you can ever ask an author is, why did you write the book, right? It's 101, don't do it. But I just think it might be illuminating for our audience if you told us, because you have some personal connection to this, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's a bunch of different reasons why I wound up writing this book when I did. But it's a book that I've wanted to write for a really long time, because I grew up in Washington, D.C. I was actually like a child professional actor, and through that got involved in the gay rights movement and the you know, protest to fight the AIDS crisis and things like that as a teenager. Which is a central part of actually the 80s and 90s culture wars in America. They were about art and about blasphemy, but they were also about the AIDS crisis and about rights for LGBTQ Americans. And then at the same time, it's Washington, D.C., which is where these fights are taking place. And my mother was actually, you know, on the board of one of the organizations that I talk about in the book. And, you know, I grew up in one of those households that got like 2 newspapers. And, you know, while they were cooking dinner, the news was on and stuff like that. So I was very aware of all of this stuff that was going on.
Yeah. And just for listeners, when you say your mother was on the board of one of these organizations involved, and not to be pejorative, but was she on the side of the angels or elsewhere?
No. She was on the board of this small arts organization called the Washington Project for the Arts. She actually joined the board in the middle of kind of one of the stories that I tell in the book, which has to do with this retrospective of work by the photographer Robert Mapplethorpe that the religious right took aim at. But no, she was on the side of the angels, so to speak. And, you know, I'm very open about that. She did not want to be interviewed for the book because she's kind of shy, but she did help me find some people from the time who shared their stories and memories with me.
Yeah. And what's fascinating and sad, which comes across in the book, and you've alluded to it, is that this seemed to galvanize people around the same time as the AIDS crisis came, but not for the good. I mean, what was it about AIDS that seemed to make the religious right really want to take on the arts? Like, what was happening at the time? Yeah. Was it that AIDS was being depicted in the arts?
To a certain extent. So it's difficult for us to remember now, or for those who are younger than middle-aged, to imagine how shut out of the public square LGBTQ Americans and people with AIDS were. So, you know, it's not like there's a lot of gay TV characters. There's, you know, the president, Reagan, doesn't mention AIDS until very late in his presidency. The Republican and religious right point of view on it is that, you know, individual responsibility will take it. Just don't have sex. You know what I mean? Don't have sex, don't do drugs, and you'll be fine. It's that usual thing. So there's a lot of victim blaming. And then at the same time, you know, there's a huge, huge stigma on people with AIDS and on LGBTQ Americans because they're the population that's most visibly contracting the virus. Mm. And so one of the artists in my book says this thing like, you know, when I contracted this virus, it didn't take me long to realize I'd contracted a sick society as well. Mm. And he's really right. So the thing is, you know, the only places where LGBTQ Americans and people with AIDS can find a voice in America at this time is, you know, the streets in protests, right? And the arts. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. Those are the two places. And the arts had traditionally been a home for queer people. And so AIDS also hit the arts extremely hard. So part of what's going on in the 80s is as the religious right is trying to gain power within American politics and particularly within the Republican Party, the point of view of people with AIDS and their loved ones and allies and queer Americans and stuff are the only place that it's really finding regular expression actually is within the arts. And so they want to crush that. You know, they do not want those people having a voice. And so they really target the American arts as a way of preventing a point of view that they disagree with from being, you know, subsidized by the federal government and expressed.
Yeah, and that's a big part of the book, that these people weren't just calling for this stuff not to be seen, but it was also that they wouldn't be funded any of these wonderful arts programs. Tell me this, there's a fascinating, and I use that word in the widest sense of the phrase, man called Donald Wildman, who I'd never heard of.
Wildman, yeah. Wildman. I mean, Donald Wildman's a really interesting character. And the part
and
of the reason
sitting
why...
at home watching Three's Company and Charlie's Angels going down with this sort of thing, basically.
Yeah, so Donald Wildman is a pioneer of media advocacy activism, particularly in the, you know, as a religious right figure. He's a reverend, kind of former reverend, who runs this organization called the American Family Association out of Tupelo, Mississippi. And he has a very active mailing list. He has a, you know, this is back before the internet, right? So he's sending out these mass mailings to thousands of Christians around the country. He's always saying something is going on in the media that's going to really piss you off and is really blasphemous and is really offensive to Christians or whatever. And then in the 70s, the MO is to get folks to engage in consumer boycotts. So they would boycott the advertisers, or because the TV networks were owned by these conglomerates that also owned, you know, like Nabisco or, you know, a tin mine, or one of them owns a coffin company. You know what I mean? It's like you could boycott the other parts of their empire as a way to punish them, right? Wow. And so he has some real successes. I think he gets Sears to stop advertising on Three's Company, if I remember correctly. He gets 7-Eleven to stop carrying Playboy, you know, stuff like that. Okay. But in the 80s, he increasingly turns his attention to what we would often call, you know, high art, right? He's not targeting TV, he's targeting avant-garde performance artists and photographers and stuff that's in museums. And the reason why, or the kind of opening he sees, is that because it's funded in part by the government. And when I say funded by the government, I should say the amount of money we're talking about in my book is incredibly small. Most of the grants are $5,000 to $10,000. Right. There's one huge controversy in my book over a grant for $150. Right. So these are not large amounts of money, but he sees within that you can make this argument that taxpayer money is being ill used. Right. Mm. That I, as a Christian, I'm paying more, you know, money to the government than the government is spending it on stuff that is offensive to me. And that's not OK. And so we need to crack down on that.
Yeah. And I presume his issue with Three's Company was there was a gay character. It was very loosely alluded to that he was gay, living with two women. And Charlie's Angels, I presume, was just that, I don't know what the problem with Charlie's Angels was.
Right. Well, the joke in Three's Company is that John Ritter's character is pretending to be gay so that he can take that other apartment. So there, I mean, with Three's Company, it's basically that it's a sex farce, right? Like Three's Company is an incredibly tame
Incredibly tame. Yes.
But it was not tame enough for him. And then in Charlie's Angels, you know, it's too violent and they're wearing bikinis and, you know, whatever. It's you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And you mentioned other arguments he had. My understanding, I'm not sure if it was him particularly involved, but the artist Andre Serrano, who I hadn't thought about in years, I read about in your book, because we were young teenagers or middle teenagers, and we heard about this thing called Piss Christ. And, you know, particularly at that time, Ireland is, but in the 90s was a very Catholic country. And for people who don't know, he was an artist who created basically an image of a crucifix behind or through urine, which seemed scandalous to a lot of people at the time. This was highly scandalous to American Christians, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Piss Christ is a really interesting example for the culture wars. Mm-hmm. First of all, I recommend that anyone who's listening to this just go look, search out the image on the internet, because what you will see is that the photograph itself is incredibly beautiful and appears totally sacred. The crucifix is in this plexiglass container filled with Andre Serrano's urine, and it's lit from behind, and it looks, you know, kind of ghostly and supernatural and holy. I mean, it's got that kind of yellow halo light and golden, and it's this really beautiful photo. And then it's paired with this title that Serrano would say is just purely descriptive. It's a crucifix, it's Christ and urine. So it's Piss Christ, right? Mm. But I mean, I think for most people, or for many people, that's a very provocative title, right? So part of the power of the work of art is you have this incredibly provocative, possibly blasphemous title, and this incredibly beautiful, possibly sacred image. And so you don't really know how to interpret it. And that gives it this incredible power and tension. I think, you know, one of the really fascinating things about this, which is a thing that actually recurs throughout my book, is that, you know, most of the people attacking this art, not all of them, but most of them are evangelical Protestants, right? Mm. And many of the artists either are or grew up as Catholics. And so a lot of this fight actually sort of goes back to the Reformation, right? It's Protestants and Catholics fighting about who gets to use religious imagery and how. You know, and Serrano is Catholic. Serrano met Pope Francis, you know, like Serrano had an audience with Pope Francis. That's how Catholic he is. Right. Mm. And so he was obsessed with the iconography of the church, and he was a collector of crucifixes. He also didn't have any money. And so it's also a work of art that's like built out of necessity. It's like, well, he was interested in having these sort of fluid immersions, and, you know, urine is a free artistic medium. And he had a lot of crucifixes lying around. So, you know, one of the questions that controversy provokes is who gets to decide whether a work of art is blasphemous? Mm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, does just because someone, you know, just because some people are offended by a work of art, does that mean it is blasphemous? Or is that a matter that's up for debate? And if it's up for debate, why does one side get to control who funds it, et cetera, et cetera, and so forth?
Fascinating stuff. And that takes us neatly to The Last Temptation of Christ.
Also a Catholic artist.
Very much so. And the thing is, I actually had a chance to interview Willem Dafoe about 3 years ago. And asked him about The Last Temptation of Christ. And it really floored him, you know, because there was stuff he got word that he wasn't allowed on his next project. And it was a massive deal for him. And, you know, he was saying, I'll always remember this. He said, all we were doing was playing around with the story a little, and they had no idea that the SH1T was going to hit the fan so much. But just your book unearthed some stuff that I didn't know about it. Like Paul Schrader, who wrote the script of that Martin Scorsese directed, his dad was possibly trying to get it banned.
Yeah, that was wild. He told me that over a salmon omelet, you know, at the place where he lives in Hudson Yards. And I was like, it just totally blew my mind when he told me that story. But yeah, so, you know, Paul Schrader, who grew up Dutch Reformed Calvinist, in a, you know, a house that was so religiously strict, he wasn't even allowed to watch movies. And then, of course, he went on to become an incredibly important film critic and then an incredibly important screenwriter and filmmaker. So be careful what you stop your kids from doing, you know, is the moral of that story. But, you know, he is the screenwriter, the named screenwriter of the film. The screenplay was actually rewritten by Martin Scorsese and Jay Cox. But anyway, so, you know, Paul Schrader is, you know, sitting at home one night while the movie's coming out, and his father, who he's not super, you know, they don't talk all the time, but his father calls him and they're talking. His father is asking him all these questions about, you know, how the movie's going, which is very rare. They didn't normally talk about his career. And then Paul Schrader asks him, he's like, "Dad, are you asking me all these questions because you're involved in the protest movement against my movie?" And his dad says, "Oh yes, but only locally."
Oh my goodness, my goodness.
That was a really fascinating time, you know, because you actually have these people who have a complicated relationship to their religious faith, but consider themselves religious. The author of the original novel was a very devout Greek Orthodox Christian. Martin Scorsese has a kind of tormented, interesting relationship to Catholicism, and of course, Paul Schrader.
Sure.
And they're trying to make an actually very sincere attempt to understand Jesus and Jesus's sacrifice and what it might be like to be called to be a prophet and to not understand what the purpose of your prophecy is, you know? And the Christian right just absolutely could not accept that. The idea of a Jesus who doubts, of a Jesus who might want to be human, of a Jesus who might have sexual feelings, you know, all of that stuff, they just could not accept it. And they really went to war over it.
Yeah, they sure did. Now, you're listening to Screen Time here on News Talk with me, John Fardy. I'm in conversation here with Isaac Butler, who's just written a fantastic new book called The Perfect Moment, God, Sex, Art, and the Birth of America's Culture Wars. We have a lot more to talk about, so we're going to take a quick ad break. Now you're listening to Screen Time News Talk's TV and movie show. I'm still here with Isaac Butler, talking to him about his fantastic new book, The Perfect Moment, God, Sex, Art, and the Birth of America's Culture Wars. And we're looking at movies and TV shows that started the culture wars, in essence. Tell me this. You know, there was a couple of other things in your book, particularly in terms of movies and TV, that I was like, God, why was there any issue with that? But Murphy Brown, which people here might remember, like,
did you all get Murphy Brown over
we
there?
We did. Yeah, okay. or I certainly did, on what we used to call piped television. And you know, that seemed like the most, now maybe it's me looking back from these very enlightened times supposedly we live in, but you know, she seemed like this cool kind of funny woman. It kind of became this idea that, you know, she was promoting single motherhood in a very unfashionable way or something along those lines.
It's you know, I remembered it from my childhood because I was a big Murphy Brown fan. My mom and I, you know, watched Murphy Brown together every week. And there's a plot line in the show where she has two boyfriends. It's her ex-husband and a man she's seeing. And she gets pregnant by one of them and she doesn't know which, and she decides to raise the child on her own. Right? That's the story. And I mean, it's totally interesting. You know, it's interesting to have a sitcom that has that kind of serious plot line in it, et cetera, and so forth. But what I remembered from being a kid is that then Vice President Dan Quayle, who we should note, Murphy Brown, the TV show, made fun of every week. They had a rule in the writer's room that there had to be one joke about Dan Quayle in every episode. Dan Quayle gives a speech where he says, you know, it doesn't help matters to have TV's Murphy Brown, you know, having a child out of wedlock and, you know, not knowing who the father is and sort of denigrating the institution of fatherhood. And everyone just thought this was ridiculous. And Murphy Brown eventually did an episode about it. You know, and everyone just thought this was very ridiculous. And, you know, everyone thought Dan Quayle was an idiot. There were just constant jokes about how stupid he was, you know, et cetera. And so it just seemed like the most absurd part of the culture wars. But I had forgotten or didn't remember that that actually came in a speech that Dan Quayle gave responding to the LA riots after the cops who beat up Rodney King were acquitted. I'm worried that this is too American inside baseball, but so really quickly,
we all remember Rodney King.
Okay, great. Right, okay, cool. Well.
Yeah.
Cool. I just don't know. I appreciate
you thinking of your audience.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to presume that, you know, I don't want to be one of those Americans that presumes that everyone follows everything American. I would much rather we just followed Irish things, but anyway, so he gave a speech in the wake of the LA riots where he's basically saying, you know, the riots weren't caused by the problems of the justice system or oppression of African Americans or whatever, but the riots are caused by welfare dependency and single parenthood and, you know, the social ills that are affecting the Black community. And then he said, you know, and we really need everyone's help on this. And, you know, we need Hollywood's help because it doesn't help that Murphy Brown, blah, 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 blah. Yeah. So it was hilarious when I was going through it, but looking back at it, I was sort of horrified that it's like, that's your response
This
riot where a group of cops, you know, nearly murdered someone with their bare hands and then got away with it. That's your response is, you know, this sitcom is too sinful.
Candace Bergen come out at any stage and go, leave us alone? Or was there anything like that? Did she ever respond to any of this outside of the show?
Well, the main way she responded was in the show. She did give interviews where she talked about it. The main way she responded to was in the show because he didn't say in the speech that she was a fictional character. Right. So what they did was they had an episode where Murphy Brown was responding to the fact that a news anchor was responding to the fact that the vice president of the United States had called her out.
Yeah.
And so that was what the episode was about, really. That was the main way that she responded.
Yeah.
But yes, she was asked and interviewed, and she, you know, she thought the whole thing was ridiculous, and she won an Emmy for that season, and you know, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, indeed. And there are lots of other TV moments in your book, The Simpsons included. But tell me this, you know, I remember, we certainly over here were aware of the hoopla about rap music and all through the 90s and stickers on albums and stuff like that. But people might forget, 2 Live Crew, they had that song, which, you know, as a adolescent, I found very amusing and all sorts of other things, Me So Horny, and it was a hit over here as well. But
now that I'm a father, I'm like, ugh, I don't know, guys.
Yeah, I hear you. I'm the same. However, it's bizarre looking back now. 2 Live Crew, who were the band from it, they had that album, like, maybe it's the only time in history this has ever happened, but they had the album taken off the shelves because it was deemed by the courts illegally obscene, right?
Yeah. So, you know, I don't know how free speech protection works in Ireland, but in the United, you know, most European countries do not actually have a guaranteed right to free expression like we have in the Constitution, right? That's why in like Germany, they can ban Nazi symbols and things like that. Yeah. You can't do that in the United States. But there has always been a carve out for obscenity. And then the definition of obscenity keeps getting changed through court cases, you know? Mm-hmm. And in fact, in my book, I sort of have what I hope is a kind of funny interlude where I try to, trace some of that history and how confusing and ridiculous it is. So the American Family Association, again, Donald Wildman, they convinced the state of Florida to attempt to ban the album for being obscene. And the reason why it's the state of Florida is that's where 2 Live Crew is based. Mm-hmm. And so they get, the government says this album's obscene. 2 Live Crew seeks an injunction. They try to get the courts to stop them. And the court says, actually, the state will likely prevail that this is obscene. So they didn't rule on whether it's obscene or not. They just said the state at this point has the right to ban it, and then you could sue them and actually argue it out, right? Mm. So the state bans them. They yank it off the shelves. It actually starts disappearing from record stores all over America as a result. And this also makes the group unbelievably popular, right? Because people want to get their hands on this banned thing. That's what happens when you ban art, you know? People want it. And so the band is growing in popularity. And then finally, they give a concert in Hollywood, Florida, in which they perform the songs off Nasty As They Want to Be, and they're arrested for obscenity. And it goes to trial. And a couple things happen once it goes to trial. One of the very funny things that happens is the album goes double platinum and they get signed to a major record label. So before they got arrested, they were literally selling their albums out of the trunks of their cars, right? Like that's the kind of level of success they had. And then eventually they, you know, their album went double platinum. And in fact, Luke Campbell, the front man, the sort of brains behind Two Live Crew, is currently running for Congress in Florida. You know, as a left-wing Democrat. So that's, you know, so he discovered the rapper Pitbull. You know, he's had a really interesting career.
Yeah. But there might be a book in him alone.
Yeah, exactly. I would love to, I mean, he should write his memoirs is really what should happen. But then they go to trial, and then they go to they need a jury to rule on whether it's obscene or not. And, the problem is the jury thinks the songs are hilarious and they just can't stop laughing. And of course, once the jury's laughing, you know, you're toast. You're toast if the jury is laughing at your supposedly obscene lyrics. And so they very quickly get ruled innocent, and they cut a single called Banned in the USA that has a sample from Bruce Springsteen's Born in the USA.
Which he willingly gave, I gather.
Yeah. He was totally into it. But what's interesting about Banned in the USA is the way that what that culminates in is that, you know, on election day, we're going to throw you all out of office. So there's actually like a level of electoral activism in that song, which I think is really interesting, that the anger over what's happened to them is going to be fueled into throwing these people out of office.
Just en route to my final question, regular listeners know I'm a big Billy Joel fan, but his song Only the Good Die Young was going nowhere in the charts, and an archdiocese somewhere in the middle of America banned it, and it shot right back up the charts. So he wrote the Archbishop saying, please ban my next record. There you go. You can have that.
That's a song that, right. That's a, well, I mean, it's a song about a Jewish guy trying to sleep with a Catholic girl. Right. Yeah. And so he's telling her, you know, only the good die young. So like, let's get into bed.
He said it wasn't anti-Catholic. It was just pro-lust, which I think is a good way of putting it. Listen,
absolutely.
Let me ask you finally, and again, this is a facile question, but it has to be asked. So, you know, here we are. Only last week, there was column inches filled about Helen of Troy and the Odyssey, who's black. There's a million signs of the cultural wars now being back in full flow. Is it just the case that art is always going and pop culture is always going to be objected to by certain sections of society, or are we in a particularly, you know, acute moment of it at the moment, do you think?
Oh, we're definitely in an acute and extremely stupid moment of it right now. I mean, I keep saying that I feel like the culture wars that I write about in the book in the 80s and 90s in the United States are kind of World War One, you know, and we're now in World War Two, because in Florida and several other states, they're banning books from schools that talk about being gay. You know, they're trying to use the levers of the state to control what people can read and see and think and stuff like that. And then you also have this sort of stupider wing of it, which is just the right wing picking fights over everything from Miller Lite to who gets to play Helen of Troy.
Yeah.
And it's very exhausting if, like me, you believe in culture, because you have to sort of like, which of these fights is worth fighting? Because you can't fight all of them. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, Christopher Nolan is a box office monster. I mean, his movies are always huge hits. So you probably didn't need to worry about them arguing about Helen of Troy. You know, like probably the way to do it is to just make fun of it and move on. But like, you know, it's exhausting having to spend so much energy on this bullshit, frankly. Oh, I can't say that, can I?
It's okay.
But it's exhausting having to do that while there's also these more serious things going on, like the government is likely getting rid of federal arts funding next year. You know, there's all these efforts to constrain what people can say. Trump is letting his, you know, helping his political cronies to buy more and more TV networks to control the discourse, and on and on and on. And that's the more serious stuff that we need to fight back against in any way that we can. that's sure. peaceful, to be clear, in any peaceful way that we can.
Well, look, hopefully this moment too shall pass. In the meantime, the perfect moment, God, sex, art, and the birth of America's culture wars is now in all good bookshops and, of course, can be bought online. I've been talking to its author. It's very important that when an author writes a great book, he's also able to talk about that great book. And he's certainly able to do that. Isaac Butler, always a pleasure.
It was great talking to you again, John.
The very articulate Isaac Butler there, talking to me about his book, The Perfect Moment, God, Sex, Art, and the Birth of America's Culture Wars. And TV and movies played a big part in that. And my thanks to Isaac for all his time. Now, talking of TV, one of the greatest shows of the last 10 years is Fleabag. And it really did change TV. And it had its 10th birthday this week. So we take a deep dive into Fleabag after the break. Now take a listen to this.
So why do you think your father suggested you come for counselling?
I think because my mother died and he can't talk about it. And my sister and I didn't speak for a year because she thinks I tried to sleep with her husband. And because I spent most of my adult life using sex to deflect from the screaming void inside my empty heart. I'm good at this. Although I don't really do that anymore.
You close with your family?
We get on with it.
Do you talk?
God, no.
Any friends?
Sorry?
Any friends?
No, I don't really have time for... Well, I have a guinea pig, but she blows hot and cold. Not a joke.
Yes, that was the unmistakable sound of Phoebe Waller-Bridge's Fleabag. 10 years ago this week, the show launched. I was going to say burst onto her screens, but in fact, in essence, it kind of whimpered online in a very quiet way on BBC Three, but then quickly became a cultural phenomenon. It seems that so many shows we've spoken about since in those last 7 years or 10 years have been described as Fleabag-esque. Writing this week in The Guardian, Simran Hans has been looking at the effect of Fleabag on female-fronted shows on TV and indeed elsewhere. Good morning, Simran. How are you?
Good morning. I'm very well. How are you?
I'm very well. Will you just, like, it's a big question, but for people who don't know, who've been living under a rock or who don't watch that much TV, Phoebe Waller-Bridge played this young, kind of nameless woman who broke the fourth wall and discussed her very messy life. Is that a fair approximation of what Fleabag was about? It's very reductive, but you tell us if you would.
Yeah, I think that was a pretty accurate assessment of Fleabag. Fleabag was a show about a young woman in her 20s who's kind of a mess. She is grieving her best friend. She works a kind of crappy job in a guinea pig themed cafe. She doesn't really get along with her family. She's got this overbearing older sister. She's going on dates. She's got a boyfriend in part of the series who's quite boring and she's not very happy with him. And she's kind of turning direct to camera as though you're her best friend and telling you all her secrets about what she really thinks about everything.
Yes. And of course, people will know that there was an Irish dimension that in season two, Andrew Scott played the hot priest that she fell head over heels in love with.
Yes, we all remember the hot priest.
Okay. So, you know, I mentioned on the intro there that, you know, so many shows that even I've talked about, like interviewed people about, like there's a show in Ireland called The Dry, which Roisin Gallagher plays this young woman getting over alcoholism, and it was constantly described as Fleabag-esque and a messy female character and stuff like that. Like, this show was huge, and I'm wondering why you think it was so huge. What was it that broke through in a way that few other things have?
Well, I think there's a couple of different things going on with Fleabag. I mean, first of all, that show is really funny. It's brilliantly written. It started as a play. And so she really got under the skin of that character and she knew that character. It started at the Soho Theatre in London. Then it went on to the Edinburgh Fringe, where it was kind of like this cult hit. So it was really well written. It was really funny. I don't know if you or anyone listening who watched that first series remembers some of like the jokes in it, but there's a scene early on where her boring boyfriend, as I mentioned, he says, I hope that we can surprise each other every day. That'll be really nice if we can surprise each other every day. So she puts on a ski mask and while he's in the shower, comes in with a knife, and then he starts crying because he's so scared. You know, I've forgotten that.
Yeah.
It's laugh out loud funny. So there's that going on. But also I think it kind of came along at a time where feminism was sort of coming into the ether and people were more interested in hearing what women had to say about their lives, about their experiences, about their romantic relationships, their family relationships. And so it sort of hit at this cultural moment when feminism was entering the mainstream. I also think that the directness of something like Fleabag was kind of quite interesting. You know, as we said, she's broken the fourth wall, so she's direct to camera. It's like she's grabbed you by the shoulders and she's whispering in your ear. It's very intimate. And I think people wanted to hear those kind of intimate stories.
Yeah. And, you know, the reason why I wanted to talk to you, Jay, was that you were writing in The Guardian this week and you're clearly a fan of it, but not that you're casting any kind of skepticism about the show, but the byline of your article is, you know, it ushered in a wave of female-fronted series, or did it straitjacket them? And what, tell our listeners what your concern is or what your thoughts are around that.
Well, sure. I mean, like, I thought 10 years would be an interesting point to kind of reflect on this cultural moment and really reconsider whether it actually had changed things and had opened doors for women. And I think in some ways, yes, it did. I think it proved there was an appetite for these both like female stories, but, you know, female creators as well, women who were writing and starring in their own shows. Although, of course, we had had that before Fleabag. You know, someone like Sharon Horgan is a pioneer of that with Pulling, which was as early as 2006, and also Michaela Cole as well. Chewing Gum had come out already. But I think, as you mentioned, this sort of swathe of female-fronted shows that then got called Fleabag-esque, what does that really mean? You know, it's kind of like a sort of shorthand that's actually a bit meaningless. I think people use it to refer to women who are a bit chaotic or a little bit messy or maybe sexually voracious, and really, like, a lot of the shows that got cast in that light are all quite different, and it flattens them a bit in a way that is maybe a bit unhelpful. Also, the sort of Fleabag trajectory was quite specific. I don't know if you remember, but after the second series got really massive and I got this big Amazon deal, she went on to kind of get a huge deal with Amazon, Phoebe Waller-Bridge, an exclusive contract writing and making shows and films for them, millions and millions of dollars. And people obviously want to recreate that kind of success, but you can't reverse engineer that. That's a kind of freak accident of a thing. She's obviously very talented. It's not that she doesn't deserve that, but that's not a realistic trajectory for everybody.
Yeah. And, you know, I suppose from the outside looking in, you know, I remember the headlines at the time. She was paid hatfuls of cash, eye-watering amounts of money. And I've read different reports on it, but millions. I mean, we saw her in the Indiana Jones, the last one, and she was very good in it. She co-wrote the last Bond movie. She's working on a new series. But I don't know, is there a sense she hasn't, and I even hate saying this because it's her life, who gives a, but is there a sense that she hasn't reached the heights maybe we thought she was going to, or is that too reductive?
Well, I mean, lots of jokes online and kind of memes and TikToks have, you know, lovingly cast her as a kind of scammer, right? Somebody who is not delivered on their promise. And I think that's a little bit unfair. Obviously, you know, great work does take many years to create.
Yeah.
But of course, people are hungry to kind of see the results of that. And when there's so much money, there's so much pressure as well. And I think one of the reasons why that show was so good is because it started off in this very scrappy, DIY, low pressure way, yeah. You know. And when you start kind of putting those constraints on things, you know, how can people really kind of exceed expectations when the expectations are so high?
Yeah. And it's so funny. Like, it just repeats itself over and over again. It's the same in the music business. It's like, you know, when U2 got huge here in Ireland, all these record executives were like, we need to find the next U2. And you know, millions were pumped into finding that. And it's the same with TV show. Like, this show began as a, as you say, a one woman play and started on BBC Three online. And like, there were such unusual circumstances that gave rise to it that trying to recreate that seems like a, you know, a wasted effort in a way.
Or maybe it could be something that people who are making those decisions and funding TV shows should look back to. In England, there have been huge cuts to funding for development schemes, for people kind of coming up from that early stage and making their first show or writing their first film. And I know there's a bit more robust funding structures in Ireland, but I think you need to really invest in those new voices and give them a chance to develop them, develop themselves, develop their work, and then maybe they'll surprise you and really hone those individual original voices.
Yeah. And look, I suppose, you know, on the plus side of things, whatever the legacy of it may be, like, it is a good thing that executives, albeit for money, after Fleabag were very interested in female writers and showrunners and actors in a way that they hadn't been.
Yeah, definitely. And the other thing that is interesting about a show like Fleabag is that it came out in 2016, and it was a co-production between the BBC and Amazon. And that was quite an early example of the streamers getting involved in British TV shows and stuff coming out of the UK. And so I think once they realized that that was not quite so niche as everybody thought, that that actually could be sold to a global audience, I think that opened up opportunities and made people think, oh, actually, really specific stories, really rooted in a place, can travel. I mean, think of something like Derry Girls.
You know, sure.
That show was a global phenomenon, but very rooted in its specific experience. Yeah.
I got into a bit of trouble the time of Derry Girls because I said I didn't think it was funny as everyone else said. However, I am clear Fleabag is one of the funniest shows ever made, and Simran Hans has reminded us of that. She's a culture writer and former film critic with The Observer. You can watch all of Fleabag on Prime Video, as it's now called. It is a terrific show. Simran, thanks a lot for talking to me.
Thanks so much, John.
Simran Hans there talking to me about Fleabag. Do check out Fleabag if you've never seen it. It's one of the greatest comedies of all time. Aside from everything else, it's just absolutely hilarious. That is it for this week. Next week on the show, we're going to be doing one of our special shows. We're going to be looking at the best superhero movies of all time. Yes, Chris Wasser and Andy McCarroll will be joining me for a look at some of the best superhero movies of all time, because the new Spider-Man movie is out. That's all to come next week. In the meantime, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email us, screentime@newstalk.com. I'll just remind you, you can listen back to this show or any show on the Go Loud app or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening. Enjoy the remainder of your weekend. Have a safe week ahead, and I will talk to you all next week.